Welcome. You are listening to The Creative Spark. My name is G. Brian Benson, and I'm an award-winning author, project coach, actor, TEDx speaker, creative, and four-time Ironman triathlete. I love to creatively inspire and be inspired. And with each episode, I will be talking of authors, athletes, entrepreneurs, artists, and actors sharing their journey of success and learning how to find the joy and peace of mind that comes with stepping into one's own skin and going beyond anything they might previously have thought possible. I hope that their stories and strategies provide insight, tools, and empowerment to step up your creative game and help you live your best life. So without further ado, let's get going. Welcome. Today we are chatting with film and documentary supervising sound editor and Americana music artist, Derek Vanderhorst. Derek has worked on some of the biggest films of the last two decades, including No Country for Old Men and Hidden Figures. And Derek's first solo album, Wildflower, will be coming out this November. In addition to being an incredibly creative person, Derek has a very inspirational story to share that played a driving part in helping him find his voice in a way that he had not done before. Welcome, Derek. How are you doing?
Good, man. How are you doing?
I am awesome.
It's good to catch up.
It's amazing to catch up with you as well. This is one of my buddies when I was living in LA, and we'll talk more about that later. But he and his partner Jay were really good friends to me. So
and she says hi, by the way.
Well, please tell her hello back.
I will.
Yeah. So, gosh, we have a lot to talk about. Let's just kind of start. I know that you've been playing instruments and music for a long time. What kind of got you into that? What inspired you and what kind of drove that?
My mom forced me into piano lessons.
So did mine, but I only took 1 year. I stopped after third grade.
I think I took like 6 years. Yeah. And then my buddy Arthur, we met in, I think, first grade, kindergarten or first grade. He started playing guitar and I was like, oh, wow, that's way cooler. So I had him teach me a little guitar.
Okay. And then you just kind of kept going with that and just kind of followed that train?
Yeah. So I went to a crazy religious school, 106 people, kindergarten through 12th, sort of Jesus camp school.
Okay.
And I wasn't sure. First of all, I didn't think they'd let me into university because, you know, we learned that the world was 6,000 years old. So I wasn't sure how I was going to get in. So I pursued music.
Okay.
And went to University of Colorado for classical, which I was terrible at. And all of us realized that right away. And then I switched to University of Colorado at Denver in their recording arts program.
Oh, wow. Okay. I can see kind of both of your careers kind of like beginning right there.
Yeah.
So then you did that. And then did you get through school and then you kind of decided to kind of put some bands together or
no.
What happened?
Well, so I had bands in school. I had a punk band at University of Colorado with an opera singer who was really into punk rock. And I think he was probably around 350 or 400 pounds. So he was this huge intimidating force on stage, which was really awesome to see. Yeah. And he would lean on the stage and people would just back up.
I mean, I can see that really being an interesting mix. I mean, just a really powerful voice like that and just you guys thrashing away.
I know. I wish I saved some recordings, but I'm not nostalgic like that or I'm not even organized enough to keep that kind of stuff, but it was really cool. Wow. You know, we did deep heartfelt songs like Too Much Sex, Not Enough TV, things like that.
What was the name of the band?
I don't even remember. That's the funny thing.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
Yeah. It was so long ago.
You had fun.
It was a blast. And then, my third year of university, I moved to San Francisco with $150 in my pocket, wanting to start a band.
Okay.
And I didn't realize at the time, because I'd never really spent time at the ocean, that it's colder by the water. And that's where I hung out on a park bench for a month or two until I got a job.
Wow. And this is the 80s, right?
This would be like 90. Yeah, 89. Oh, 89.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I was like, wait, I went to college in 86. It's I forget.
So you got another band together there?
Yeah, I got a band called the Rosemarys.
Okay.
I got a job at Guitar Center and then rented a closet from this guy Vinay who worked there, and we still keep in touch.
Oh wow.
And then started a band with the drummer who worked at Guitar Center, and then he knew a keyboard player and singer. And the band was the Rosemarys, and we did, you know, light touring and recorded a little and, you know,
played a lot. Punk or is it more kind of like 80s electric or, you know,
It was like Ride and Lush and Sundays, Stone Roses, that kind of British pop.
Nice.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then as skills get better, I think your music changes.
you have more options.
I remember Chrissy Hynde from Pretenders goes, they interviewed her. It was awesome. And she goes, they go, well, why'd you stop playing punk? And she goes, oh, well, we learned to play our instruments.
That's so true. That's hilarious. Yeah, but
punk is like, I'm not saying that they don't know how to play their instruments, because it's awesome. Like, yeah. It's kind of my favorite. Like going back and listening to the Circle Jerks or, you know, any of those kind of, the Ramones, you know, it's awesome.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. So then did you make your way to LA then, or how long were you in San Francisco?
I was there a couple of years and then kind of got itchy for change, and then came to LA and worked at, you know, guitar stores or whatever, kind of just to make it. And then ended up at an internship at a company called Hard Copy. Mm-hmm. It was a TV show. It was kind of the first tabloid television.
I think I remember it. I don't remember really watching it, but I remember the name.
Yeah, it was, you know, it's like any of those tabloid TV shows. It was an early version of that. And I held boom on that and then started booming for some movies and things. And then decided I wanted to do more post-production. So I was thinking about getting into that. And then my grandmother was dying and she was like, you just have to get your degree. That's all I can. So I went home for a year, finished my degree in the recording industry program at CU Denver, and then came back.
Did that, do you think having your degree helped you get back in, or were you kind of already making some good inroads prior to that?
I think it did. I came out for an internship at a place called EFX, which is no longer in existence. And my car broke down the first day and I was late. So I got fired my first day on internship, and then, which led to a paying gig, but they never paid me. So I worked there for like 6 months. And then at the end, we all kind of just went into the building and took a bunch of equipment out because the owner fled to Europe. And we like each took a piece of equipment so we could sell it and kind of pay our rent.
Damn.
And at the same time, I was interning at a place called DSP during the days, mixing Foley at nights at this other place. And, you know, it was like 16, 18 hour days. And what I didn't realize at the time, I was like, oh shit, two jobs, that's a lot. Because that's kind of the hours you spend with one job in film.
Right. I mean, that's leading, that led to the almost strike that you guys had recently.
Yeah. It was pretty brutal hours for sure.
Well, there's so many different, I know that I'm kind of confused by a lot of it. And so I'm sure some of the, my listeners are as well. There's a lot of aspects of sound editing. Can you explain some of the different parts, like, you know, the sound design, sound mixing, Foley, all that kind of, like, break it up for us?
Yeah. So when they film on the set, a lot of times, especially now, even more than, you know, 30 years ago, they're using two or three cameras at once. When it was film, they generally used one camera. So now they can shoot the close-ups and the wide shots at the same time mm-hmm. because of the way they can zoom on these new cameras. So sound is primarily, not always, but, you know, primarily lavs when they're shooting like this.
Right. When you have a lav mic.
Yeah, when you have a lav clipped onto your shirt or whatever, it or, you know, underneath your shirt, you don't pick up any ambient sound. All you get really is the dialogue, mm-hmm. The person speaking. So we have to create the soundtrack around that, which includes, you know, the air, birds, crickets, church bells, winds, you know, all those kinds of things, which are the backgrounds. And then we'll, you know, when they shoot films, if they're in a car or something, it's being towed and they have cameras on the truck that's towing it. So you don't really have an engine sound. So we have to create all that as well. And then, you know, jet planes, helicopters. So those are effects. Sword battles are usually, you know, not done with metal, although sometimes they are if they practice a lot.
I'm sorry, keep going.
Oh, well, I was going to say, so we create all that as well.
I know there's a particular, what is a person called who is like, does all the sound effects? You know, it's very interesting. They have all kinds of different things that they use that you wouldn't even think would make the noise that they're making.
But, yeah, it's a sound effects editor, really.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, and then we'll record all kinds of things. And then there's a sound designer, which kind of is in charge of the overall soundtrack. For the film. And then there's Foley, which is recorded by human beings, and that's anything a human being might do, like set down a telephone or walk across the street or so we'll get the feet. A cop running will have, you know, his leather gear and his metal, whatever that is, handcuffs or gun, or whatever he's carrying. So there's those kinds of things, you know, just lip smacks, pat on the back. Anything you hear, because also when we take out the dialogue, even if it does pick it up, these films go to Europe where they don't speak English, so we mute all of that.
So they can dub it.
Yeah, so it becomes essentially an animation piece, right, with no sound.
Wow.
Or limited sound, so we have to recreate all those sounds.
Sure. Well,
let me in the film.
Yeah, yeah. So let me ask you this. I mean, are all of those sounds that we hear that like an actor is making, are they all recreated or some of them authentic from like just what they picked up while they were doing it?
A lot of it's authentic, but you know, we will recreate all of it 100% because when we do take out the dialogue, it's not going to exist there. Okay. But we highlight stuff too, or we emphasize stuff like a door close. It might be a set door. So it sounds like a big, you know, like fake walls and a fake door closing. So we'll, you know, put a real door in, things like that.
Do you, how's that? Okay. So when that is delivered to you, do you, somebody from the project tell you what they want highlighted, or they just kind of say the ball's in your court now, this is what we're working with, trust that you're going to do it, or do you have instructions? You know what I mean?
No, we, anything you see, we will make a sound for.
Yeah. Okay.
And then we will have discussions on kind of designy things like, you know, if you're working on a Matrix movie or something like that, or Terminator or whatever, we'll have general concept kind of ideas with the director. We'll also have discussions about what dialogue they want to replace, any new lines they want to put in, dialogue we want to replace for technical issues. You know, because if somebody's running and they have a lav mic on, all you hear is scratching and thumping. So we'll have to replace kind of those lines. Or, you know, if somebody pats themselves on the chest, you're going to just going to beat on the mic. So there's technical reasons why we'll replace as well.
Right. So you do a lot of ADR work at the end there with the actors.
We do. We try and use other takes so we don't have to do a lot of ADR. But yeah. And, you know, honestly, like most movies, they want to, you know, they're like, oh, we should write a line for that. And so the movie's kind of being written even after it's done being shot. So on the back of a head, we might throw a line in. Or there's times where you're like, oh, shit, that obviously isn't what they said. And we'll just like squeeze a line into their face, throw it in their mouth as best we can.
That's hilarious. You have any fun stories of working with anybody that had to come in and clean up some stuff or?
So
that you can
directors
share?
Generally do not like ADR.
Okay.
And I don't know why they don't. They just don't. It's everyone's decided they don't like it. But when I recorded Al Pacino, he came in, he goes, "Oh man, this is my favorite part of the movie. I gotta make it better."
But he was being serious.
Yeah.
Wow. Absolutely. Nice. What yeah. movie was that?
Stand Up Guys.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's interesting because I bet a lot of them just like, man, this is the last thing I want to do.
It is.
Because they're done filming and it's like on to the next thing or they're taking a break or whatever. It's
I've had actors cry on the ADR stage.
Oh, wow.
Literally break down into tears. Because it's unnerving for them. The ones who are
well, it's a lot of pressure. I mean, they're watching the film while they're trying to match their dialogue, right?
Their inflection, their projection, their like everything.
Stressful.
Stressful, but the ones who have done music and things are amazing at it because they hear it and they can repeat it just like, you know, they're singing a song or something. Mm-hmm. And then surprisingly, like if you know, they go in with the right attitude. It's always great. It always helps in the movie.
Yeah. Energy's everything, man.
Yeah. And, you know, if they go in with the other attitude, then it's always bad. Like life.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
So you've worked on a lot of big films. Like I mentioned earlier, No Country for Old Men, Hidden Figures, 300, you know, talking about the sword sounds. And Ray, you know, just name a few. What has that been like, and what is the difference between maybe a big, big budget film and something that's like a really amazing documentary, but that it's, you know, funded, it's completely different?
Budget is the big thing.
Yeah.
Like, just time. On like a Terminator or something, you know, you've got a year.
Mm.
300, you've got, you know, months and months. Mm. Things like that. On the smaller films, you get less people and much less time.
Okay.
The good part of that is you get to control kind of the soundscape more. So I might especially on documentaries, I might do the effects, backgrounds, and the dialogue editing, all of that, and then mix it. And then on some of the bigger films, I might just mix the dialogue and music or just mix effects rather than mixing the whole thing.
Cool. Wow. So fascinating. So you were invited to become a member of the Academy of Motion Pictures. So do you get to vote for the Oscars?
I do.
What is that like? Is that a fun process for
it's
you?
It's one of my favorite things. we go to, so, and this is definitely, I feel spoiled. and look forward to, we get to go to the screeners. They hold them for Academy members at different places. And generally the actors and directors will show up. Not last year because of COVID, but the year before, like we went to one with Elton John and Bernie and they were talking and then they hung out afterwards. So like when you get things like that, you feel definitely spoiled.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it's, you know, the glory of this job, really, like Hollywood, you know, whatever. Magic is you sit in a dark room by yourself for 360 days a year, and then 5 days is you actually get to go out and
walk the red carpet
and enjoy it. Yeah, yeah.
That is such a big
It's like, oh wow, that must be amazing, and it's like, well, I sit at a computer in a dark room by myself for.
Well,
and then mixing is the weirdest thing because you might have 20 people behind you all like kind of barking out requests like, oh, turn that up, turn that down, oh, get rid of that, I don't like that, like you made that, can you clean that up, can't hear. So you have to kind of like, it's the one of the few jobs where you're sitting at a desk and people are just yelling at you from behind telling you what to do.
Great.
So it definitely takes a personality type to be able to handle not only the stressful part of it but also kind of decipher the most important requests.
Yeah.
As you're working. Yeah. Yeah. It's a weird job.
Well, you know, hey, it's fascinating to me. I mean, obviously you've done really well at it and you have to be sharp and you have to you know, like you said, no, you know, just use a lot of intuition, I would imagine.
Yeah. And you might have 1,000 tracks of material you're going through, once.
Yeah.
So just to be able to move through that quickly and efficiently and control the room and, you know, inspire confidence in the people, to the people behind you, like all of that is an art, and it takes, a lot of time and good people training you, and it's not something you can kind of just step into, even though like kids are learning the technology a lot better, which is great, because it then we can focus more on the artistic side of it rather than the technical when they come in. But kind of learning all that is it takes a lot of time, and I've seen some of my favorite sound designers or sound editors try and mix. And, I've seen a lot of meltdowns.
Yeah. Yeah. So you're going great guns with all this. And in 2016, you had kind of a, there's no better way than a really shitty experience.
Yeah. 2016 was not a good year. I had diagnosed with head and neck cancer. I was actually working on a film, and I said to the, to the picture editor, I was like, I got a lump on my neck. I got to go get this checked out. And he goes, oh, get it done after the movie. If it kills you, it's on me.
Oh, my God, great.
And by the way, he's one of the sweetest guys in the world and was totally kidding.
Of course.
So, mostly. But I think he felt bad when it was a cancer diagnosis.
I mean, from some of our walks, last year when I was kind of going through my own experience, that you and Jay were incredibly supportive, and I'm very grateful for that. I mean, some of what you went through, I just can't even imagine. I mean, your experience was 100 times worse than mine. I mean, do you want to share any of that?
Yeah, it's a weird thing because it's one of those where the doctor goes, hey, here's the good news. You're probably going to live. Here's the bad news. It's going to be the worst treatment you can possibly imagine. Ugh. And my oncologist described it as, I was like, well, what's a treatment going to be like? He's like, well, if you took, like 100 ball bearings and then heated them up to 1,000 degrees and put them in your mouth and started swallowing them, that's kind of going to be your experience for the next 2 months.
Oh, brother.
And so that was, and he was right. So what they do is they radiate the tumor, mm-hmm. Which is basically giving you a third degree sunburn every time you walk in, which is every morning. And then you get, on top of that, you're getting chemotherapy and stuff. So getting infusions of chemotherapy. But, it's once it starts burning enough where your whole throat and mouth start having third degree burns, they generally give you a feeding tube because you can't swallow. So I would take more morphine and swish it in my mouth, and it just burned like hell. So I'd be like in tears, and then I would drink an Ensure over like a half hour in tears, and then just go to bed from exhaustion. Because I lost 18 pounds, they were going to give me a feeding tube. And once you get a feeding tube, there's a high likelihood of losing your swallow muscles. And I didn't want to lose my swallow muscles.
No.
Eating tube the rest of my life. It's the same thing, Val Kilmer, same cancer, right?
Okay. Oh my gosh. Where did you get the strength just to kind of keep staying with it and positive?
I'm just stubborn. I think that's it. Like just stubbornness, because you can lose your tongue. I actually lost the ability to talk for a while too. Mm-hmm. And then, it was just kind of a whisper, and talking even for a year after, was exhausting because mm-hmm. the muscles were just destroyed and, the throat muscles, all of that. So I, never sang. But I was like, oh, shit, I'll take some singing lessons because that'll help strengthen, all those muscles.
So
I just, you know, it was because of my schedule, I was like, oh, I'll try and do something online. And then I found a great teacher online who actually does rehab also.
Perfect.
Yeah, yeah.
When you were starting to do the singing lessons, just to kind of try to get the strength back in your voice, did you also have in the back of your mind that I'm going to do this and I'm going to freaking sing and put an album out?
No.
Okay. That was a little later.
Really. I was like, I thought about it and then I was like, oh man, I sound like a really cartoony version of Tom Waits. because of all the damage. And I was like, yeah, there's no way. So I'll just continue this. And, you know, I lost all my saliva in the process of the treatments and stuff. So it's, you can't really swallow. And there was a whole, issue with that as well. But after a year of doing it, or maybe even a little longer, I had started writing music again. Mm-hmm. I think probably, you know, because of COVID as well, right? Like we all just had nothing to do for a little while.
You're practicing your guitar a ton too. You were really getting back into it.
Yeah, I stopped playing for 20 years. Didn't even touch it. And, with my OCD, I kind of picked it up quickly again because I just, you know, played 8 hours till my fingers bled, as they say, in Spinal Tap. So...
You turn it up to 11 too?
I turned it up to 11. Nice. My acoustic guitar to 11. And yeah. and so I started playing and writing a bunch of songs and I went through an exercise where I'm like, okay, I'm going to write a song a day. So I wrote a song a day for 150 days. Most of them terrible, you know, because you're just trying to crank them out and exercise that muscle.
Yeah.
It was just, you know, to kind of just force myself to do it. And then at the end of it, I was like, oh shit, I got all these songs. I'm going to pick some that, you know, like a bunch of them you would play and you'd be like, oh, I'm sick of that one already. And then a few of them, you're like, oh yeah, that one's okay. I'm going to, let me find a singer and, record an album. So I found a singer and recorded like 3 or 4 demos with him. And which went great, you know, just kind of did it at home. And I was, you know, it was during COVID, so you couldn't really go into a studio and do it properly. And I don't have the gear for music or didn't at the time, or the room to record drums, things like that. And so I was waiting. And as I was waiting, I was kind of refining the songs, but also taking singing lessons. And by the time I could record, I was like, you know what? I'm going to try singing this myself. And so I went into the studio and I was just going to hire musicians, whoever was at the studio kind of thing. Like, oh, that guy plays drums? Yeah, I have him play on my album. And so I started that way. And then I have a buddy, Mike Valerio. And if you look him up, insane credits from like, you know, he plays on John Williams, you know, Star Wars and all that.
Oh yeah.
From like his tours to like everybody, like, you know, James, he's kind of just plays on everything. And I sent him a couple songs and he was like, dude, let me play on this. And
nice.
So he kind of took over the producing a little bit. He got me, well, him, which is insane. I also got, a bass player on some of the songs from Gary Clark Jr. And then I don't think he plays with Gary anymore, but he played with him for years. And then I got Gabe Witcher, who is one of the top fiddle players, like bluegrass fiddle players of all time. Like he's incredible.
Wow.
And then this guy, Jimmy Paxson on drums, and he's, you know, on tour with Lindsey Buckingham right now, just to give you an idea what kind of drummer he is. And he's crazy. Like when first day he came over, he He's like, oh, will you help me unload my van? I was like, yeah, sure. He had three trash cans in his van. I'm like, what do you have three trash cans for? He goes, they all sound different.
Oh my god.
So he had a trash can. Like he had, it was, it took us an hour and a half to move all the shit out of his van and set it up. Stick it up. Not including a drum kit, just stuff.
Oh my god.
So it was fascinating. Like it was like Bertolt Brecht, Tom Waits kind of land working with him. Yeah, and he's amazing. We've become good friends.
So what was the recording process like? Were you nervous? Were you like a kid in a candy store? Or were you just wearing a huge smile knowing how much you went through to get to that place?
Well, so it was very telling because when I started singing lessons a year and a half before that time, I could sing maybe one line without choking. And we went in the studio, and I think I cut 8 or 9 songs the first day, guitar and vocals.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and the mixer was like, shit, I've never seen anyone be able to sing that long without hurting themselves. And I attribute it 100% to my teacher, of course.
Mm. Well, you, I mean, and all the countless hours that you
practicing. The hours, like, he's so... all he cares about is you not injuring yourself. Mm. So all his exercises and everything are around developing strength and coordination with all your muscles.
Yeah.
So it went great.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And then, you know, the first time I kind of recorded with musicians who I didn't know, and then started, you know, sent it to Mike, and then Mike's like, hey, you know what, I want to play on that. And then he sent it to Gabe Witcher, and Gabe's like, yeah, I want to play on that. And then he's like, hey, my buddy Jimmy will redo the drums. And then and not that the other guys were, I mean, they were great,
yeah,
but this was just a whole next level of you definitely, when you're making an album, you want to be the worst person on it, I found. Now I listen to it, I just enjoy it. I'm like, oh my god, that violin part, that fiddle part is amazing.
No, it's awesome. I've listened to a handful of the songs, and you shared a lot of them with me as they were kind of going through the process last year, and I loved them then, even when they were just kind of like, you know, demos and such. Very proud of yourself. Yeah. So you know, earlier on you made mention that you hope to empower others, you know, that it's never too late to find your voice. And prior to doing this album and really diving into the process of becoming a singer-songwriter, was there a part of you that didn't feel like you were complete?
Well, I think what the lockdowns taught all of us, and you can kind of see it by you know, McDonald's not having enough people to work, so they just open their drive-thrus, is that we all become like a slave to work. And, you know, we work 40 years or 50 years to save up enough to hopefully be healthy enough to spend 5 years enjoying it, it seems like. And so it was kind of a wake-up call to the world. And I think you had that wake-up call too, right?
Yeah, you know, I felt like it gave me, you know what, again, I'm curious as to what you felt as well when you went through your situation, but I mean, it kind of gave me permission to get off the hamster wheel for a little bit and not feel, it gave me permission to say no to things I didn't want to do.
Say no and not feel guilt and not feel an obligation and not feel, like, we got to actually look at ourselves and go, and look at our lives and go, oh, wow, this is kind of not how we're supposed to live.
Right. And I was doing a lot of pushing and pressing, trying to make things happen. And I wasn't really enjoying the process. And so I kind of stepped off a little bit. And as you know, I went on, you know, that 5.5 month RV trip around the U.S., which just really healed me in a lot of ways. But it also really just kind of gave me my creative mojo back. And it just made me really connect with others in a way that I've never connected before. And so it gave me a lot of gifts. And for that, you know, I'm really grateful.
Right. I mean, even though it's America, right? It's like there's so many cultures.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
From like city to city, even like, I mean, even in L.A., if you go from here to Palm Springs, it's a totally different culture, or San Diego or Bakersfield or San Francisco. And then doing that across Malibu. The country. Malibu. You just see all this, these different cultures. Like I've spent time, you know, in like Mississippi and, you know, if you go to Arkansas or Oklahoma or Tennessee, North Carolina, New York. If you go upstate, like to Maine or Vermont, like it's just different cultures from every city and every state in the country, and it's super cool.
Yeah, I'm so grateful that I listened to my intuition and did that. You know.
Yeah. Because we get in our bubble, right?
For sure.
And we can't see out of it, you know. And that's kind of what's going on in the world today, with all the, you know.
It's kind of a reawakening.
Yeah. And it's super cool. And then the people who are, you know, all fighting each other, they haven't been out of their bubble enough, and they need to get out and go see that everyone's pretty cool.
Yeah, we all want the same thing, man.
We all want the same thing.
Love and be loved.
Yeah. Yeah, we're like puppies with just treats and love and some sleep.
Yes. Yeah. So you're starting to play live a little bit, right? Recently.
I am. Things are opening up a little. So I'm starting to play live for the first time.
What was that like? I would have been just.
I think
really
I shit
scared.
Myself the first time. Because, okay, so I'd been in bands and toured, and I played like, you know, huge shows. Even my last big show was probably 98 at the San Diego Music Awards. And I think probably one of the last times I touched a guitar, maybe 98, 99, I can't remember which year it was. And I was always playing with someone. So I wasn't singing. I was just kind of in the background, you know, playing guitar, which is still nerve-wracking, but a whole different thing. You're with an acoustic guitar and you, yeah, it's like you're naked. It's that dream you had when you were a kid, naked in front of class.
I'm so proud of you.
And it is that every single time. And what you find out is everyone wants you to do well and wants you to have a good time and wants you to succeed, and they want to be there and hear you. So it's hard to, you know, like if you make a mistake, like, you know, you start swirling around that a little bit at first. And then now I'm like, I make so many mistakes, I'm getting used to it. So it's it doesn't bother me nearly as much. But it's still, you know, I never thought I would play live because I never enjoyed it. It would take, you know, a little vodka for me to get on stage in the old days. And now, you know, I don't really drink or anything. So now I have to go up there and, you know, by myself.
I love it. Man, that's just... I've done that a little bit of that, not singing, but in different ways. And there's a part of me that knows I need to kind of continue pressing myself, whether it's a speaking engagement or what have you. But I mean, that just, it's just got to be total freedom.
It's freedom and scary. I mean, from speaking live in front of a,
but when you're done, you're just going, I just conquered my fears. You know what I mean? I just stepped into them.
You do have the self-doubt, like, is what I'm saying or singing or playing important enough for anyone to be looking at or listening? Like, it's, you go through all that, right?
Of course. Ultimately, it's just, if it matters to us and it makes us happy, that's all that matters. And people will get on board with that.
Yeah. And the older you get, the more you realize that it's, you know, it doesn't. What you're doing is cool, and people do want to hear it. People want to be around each other, and people want to experience music and experience, you know, talks and experience each other. And it's more of a community thing. It just turns into a community thing. And for some reason, you're up there, you know, kind of leading the campfire song at the moment. And, you know, it's just, it's a really cool thing.
Absolutely. There was someone, I don't remember where I saw it, but I try to remember this, you know, it's like, it's not about me. It's about sharing me.
Yeah, it really is. Yeah.
And that kind of takes some of the pressure off, I think.
Yeah. And music is a weird thing. Like, I don't know where it comes from. It just does. And then you get to share it.
Yeah. Well, I've got three or four questions here that I'd like to ask everybody just to kind of just see what they say. And one of them was kind of, you dialed right into it. It's like, where do your ideas and creativity come from?
Sometimes a line. Like, I went to write a country song and I was like, I told Jay, she was, we were together and I was like, wouldn't it be funny if I was like, just wrote a song like, if you're going to love somebody, why the hell not me? And I was like, that's so country.
I love it.
And then I threw a bicycle into the lyrics and I was like, okay, that can't be country anymore. They'll really make fun of me. So it became a folk song. Right. Like I was like, oh, I want to write about my bicycle too. So how do I do that in a song? And then, you know, so it's just weird things like that. Or sometimes I'll just sit down and like play the guitar and then all of a sudden have a song in 10 minutes. I just wrote a song for a film called Wild and Free that'll be coming out next year. Oh, and awesome. The director came over with the script and we looked at it and then like I just wrote the song. And then sometimes it takes 6 months to write the song to finish it. And then what I'm weird about the lyrics, like I want them to be kind of perfect. Mm-hmm. So I'll write a song and then I'll kind of be just like tweaking the lyrics for literally even while I'm recording.
Sure.
Like I was tweaking the lyrics. Oh yeah, that does it. I could say that better. That word, I don't even need that word or whatever it is. So it's kind of a long process, but sometimes it starts with a line. Sometimes it starts with a guitar thing or a keyboard thing or whatever.
So you don't necessarily go music first, lyrics second. Sometimes you go lyrics first, music second.
Yeah, it doesn't for me. I don't really have a method. And you know, I listen to like Dolly Parton interviews and she's like, just lock me away for a week and I'll come out with an album if I have the time. Wow. And like to write 12 brilliant songs in a week like she does, I don't even understand that, because I got to write 20 songs for me to be happy with, you know, one or two of them.
Well, you're very prolific. I mean, I was amazed at, you know, just watching you in action last year. Yeah,
I think I should like just write for people, because like I can write a lot of songs and styles. Mm-hmm. And it might suit me better, but since I have stage fright, but you know, I'm getting over the stage fright, so I'm starting to enjoy it a little bit more. Yeah.
I love it. What, any advice you'd give to an up and coming singer songwriter?
So for singer songwriters, like, and there's so many of us, and I'm like at the bottom of my career. Like I'm not, you know, but what I hear is like importance in lyrics rather than story in lyrics.
Hmm.
And I think,
what does that mean?
Like you're trying to say something important, which I think is better told in a story. I think the storytelling aspect of music for singer-songwriters mm-hmm. is the most most important thing, more than melody, chord, anything. Is just the, like you listen to the greats, you listen to
like John Prine,
right? Not a great voice, not a great guitar player, a great songwriter, which made him had a great voice and made him a great guitar player.
Yeah.
Because his stories were so cool.
And Tom Waits.
Like Nick Cave. Yeah. Like you listen to these kind of like masters of the craft. And you know, it's pretty incredible. And there's so many good, I should have put a list together, but you know, like Isaac Hoff, like all these guys, like new singer songwriters in the last 10 or 15 years. Elliot Smith, right? Like he kind of probably set this all in motion again, because the singer-songwriter, we had like singer-songwriter and then it kind of went to disco, then it kind of went to punk rock and then rock. And then, you know, we had the shreds of Eddie Van Halen, which was awesome, you know, that kind of music. But then where was music going again, right? And then Elliott Smith comes along and we, you know, hear Good Will Hunting, that soundtrack, and it kind of spurred the singer-songwriter again.
Yeah, you know, I guess, you know, like a Jack Johnson and Donovan Frankenreiter and some of those guys like that. I mean, I remember I dated a woman in the late 90s, early 2000s, and we went to a lot of concerts. And there was a lot, it seemed like there was a lot, kind of a little bit of a resurgence of the singer-songwriter around that time. I don't know.
Yeah, and I attribute a lot of that to Elliott Smith, right? Like 95, 96, Rob Schnapp produced him, like everything that he then back, you know, and he like, you know, and now we have like Americana making a huge resurgence. I just saw Billy Strings, who's one of the best flatback guitar players. He's the kid. I mean, he's a kid and you listen to him and it's mind blowing, but he's in the top three or four album sales right now.
Well, you know, I love the Yvette Brothers and Mumford & Sons, you know, and I think Mumford & Sons kind of helped kind of kick that into gear, you know, 10 years ago or what have you, right? I mean, a little bit.
Yeah.
They got big, but yet those guys are amazing.
Yeah. And Yvette Brothers, like you said, Gold Crow Medicine Show, like, you know, those kind of Americana bands.
Brandi Carlile.
Brandi, oh my God, right?
Yeah.
Like, what a voice. Yeah. And have you heard her duet with, Dolly Parton, like hearing
I
that.
I have not.
Yeah. Super cool.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's a whole world of music. I remember going through a phase of music where I was like, I don't like anything new. I would just listen. I'm like, oh, just give me some Simon Garfunkel or whatever. Right. And I would just put on some old, you know, or, you know, I grew up in the 80s. So I love The Cure and The Smiths and R.E.M. and Depeche Mode and all of that as well. But there was a period where I was like, and now the last 10 or 15 years, like, it's amazing again to me. And maybe it's just I'm finding it because of the new methods of listening to music, like Spotify, things like that, where
I think that definitely helps, right? You put a certain person in there and they start putting in other stuff of people you didn't hear that's in the same genre.
Yeah, man, it's so cool. And I know, like, especially new artists and things complain about, you know, the online streaming services and stuff, but it gives, what I'm seeing is like, I get emails from people in like Detroit, which 15 years ago, I would have had to play Detroit to get any, you know, like for anyone to hear me. I'd have to, you know, go play some bar in Detroit. And now it's like, they hear it on YouTube or whatever. And then I get like little emails and stuff. And so we also have an opportunity to reach a much bigger fan base. Now, the problem is, I think there's like 40,000 songs or something a day uploaded. So how do you get through all that?
Sure.
I don't even know if you can. Like somebody can. I don't know if I can, but I think you just, you know, keep pushing forward and see what happens. I think playing live is kind of the only avenue now. But you know, so, or take out ads. I actually did a YouTube ad, you know, because when I first released the songs and it was very effective.
Oh, it was okay.
Yeah. So, just to kind of, you know, you can sit there with two listeners, or you can like target the ad to, hey, everyone who likes Yvette Brothers, check this out. And you know, if they listen for 30 seconds, you got to whatever.
Okay. I think it's that time where we kind of wrap things up, brother. I want to let everybody know that Derek's first solo album, Wildflower, will be available just in a couple of weeks in November. And for more information about upcoming live events and the album release party, please join his mailing list via his website, DerekVMusic.com. And
that's the short Derek, D-E-R-E-K, many spellings.
Ah, yes. Okay.
And V as in Victor.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Because I get a lot of people going, Derek B, and it's like, well, close.
Whenever I say my name, I'm like on the phone, somebody say, Denson? No, Benson. But yeah, I got you.
Yeah, I'm friends with comedian Tig Notaro.
Yes.
We kind of moved out to LA together, and it was funny because she'd be on the phone and people would be like, Pig? No, Tig. they would always get her name wrong.
Oh my God. I get it.
Yeah.
Okay. And he has a Facebook page, Derek V Music, and an Instagram handle is Derek VH Music.
So, yeah, V wasn't available. Some guy's not been active for 10 years. And, I don't know. Do I contact him? I don't know. That's why I need professional help.
We'll leave that one alone. But so we're going to, you've been very kind. You're going to sing us a song and lead us out of here. So I will just be quiet and you do your thing. And thanks again, brother. It was a lot of fun chatting. Yeah, my pleasure.
I'm going to, should I set this song up for a second?
Sure.
So my buddy, because you remember I went to crazy religious school. He was out visiting and we went to a restaurant in Santa Monica. You know, I think I met him when he was five, I was six, or we were both six. I can't remember, but, and we had another buddy who came into the school when he was seven. So a year later, Jimmy. And then I was like, man, I still have his mom's phone number. Cause neither of us had talked to him in like 10 years. So Arthur goes, give me that number. I'll call her right now. And he called her and found out that he had just passed away. Mm. And then right after that, COVID hit. So this was kind of a song inspired by all of that.
Okay.
And it's called It's All Right. And I think it's on YouTube. I put this one up, like a preliminary version of it. So if anyone wants to go on YouTube and listen too. With a sweet violin and bass and percussion. Hmm. All right, so this one's for Jimmy. It's all right, it's all right. If you're leaving here tonight. It's okay, it's okay. If you haven't got the words to say. It's a long way to go, where I don't know, I don't know. It's a dark and lonely road that leads you home. And I wonder where you are tonight, I wonder if tell me, do the stars shine bright and light your way? All right, the wrongs, all right, the wrong. Can I be strong? Can I be? For a while, for a while. But I'm growing tired, I'm growing tired. Are you happy, are you sad? Do you love the friends you have? Come along, come along. You're here with me, you're in my song. And I wonder where you are tonight. I wonder if you'll be all right. Tell me, do the stars shine bright and light your way? Where will you go? Will you go? Will you know you're not alone? You're in my heart, you're in my song. I'm with you all alone. The winds will chase the rains away. The morning brings a bright new day. And I wonder where you are tonight. I wonder if we'll be all right. Tell me, do the stars shine bright and light your way?
Thank you for listening to The Creative Spark. To learn more about host G. Brian Benson, his latest best-selling book, Habits for Success, and this week's amazing guest, please visit the show notes. And we love building community, making new friends, and spreading the goodness, so don't forget to subscribe to this podcast and share it with your friends and family. Until next time, as Brian always says, be well, be creative, and always be yourself.